Hi and welcome to It's About Youth, the show that talks about things that matter to youth. I'm Fana Shea. Now, despite the pandemic placing the world at a standstill, the gaming industry has been thriving, not just in Malaysia and Southeast Asia, but also globally. Game developers are exploring new gaming experiences to keep up with this popularity, including one that raises important social issues we are all facing today. We have three very exciting guests with us today. Lindsay Grace is a video game designer, professor and writer who has researched, taught and developed games extensively with a focus on creating a social impact through gaming. We also have Sakina Latif with us, one of the founders of Persona Theory Games, an indie narrative game studio that tells compelling Southeast Asian stories through games and interactive experiences. There's also William Chong, a seasoned video game developer, currently leads a small Penang-based indie game studio as a creative director and studio producer called Twilight Foundry Games. Welcome to It's About Youth. Thank you so much for joining us today. All right, let's just get into it. Now, just based off the short bios that I've read of the three of you, I'm pretty sure to the people sitting on this couch right here, video games are more than just things that we spend our time on or things that we use to escape. It's a lot more that we can do with it, right? So making socially conscious games that addresses pressing challenges in the region, for example. How do you think, Lindsay, how can games help in promoting social change? And any examples that you can share with
us? Sure. So a lot of the history around what we call social impact games is more than 1,000 years old. A lot of the games we play are designed to try and help us understand the world through some other perspective or to understand some operation. One of the easy examples is the game Monopoly. It was originally designed to explain a certain kind of economics, and it was originally designed to give us both ends of that economics, what drives poverty, but also what drives wealth.
Yeah. So that's a good example. Sakina, your indie game narrative also explores, Southeast Asian stories and trying to highlight that. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, when I first started, I saw a game called Never Alone, and that had indigenous culture into a game. And I thought that would be the perfect, games are a perfect medium for us to tell our Southeast Asian culture through games. And that's been the backbone of Persona Theory Games, and we work closely with an NGO called Pusaka, with Pauline and Edin Koo, who works closely with families that work on Mayong, Kuda Kepang, Wayang Kulit. And every time we looked at those kind of cultures, we were thinking, how do we share this with the world? And we think that games is like the perfect medium, because once we create a game, the whole world have access to it and the whole world can experience what it means to be Southeast Asian.
It's also interactive and fun, and people can sort of participate in a more interactive manner, not just like reading a book, for example, or watching a TV, right?
Yeah.
William, what about you? What's your experience in creating games that are socially conscious of the issues around us?
Right. So the inspiration that comes when I was forming Twilight Foundry Games actually came from these two.
Oh, okay.
So I was actually an ex-employee at Persona Theory Games, and last year we hosted Professor Lindsay Grace at Penang Game Developers Exchange. It's like a state government initiative to build a community for game devs, to expose game dev to kids, and just the general public to reduce the stereotype, to combat the stereotype of video games being a source of a time-wasting thing.
Yeah.
So When I started Twilight Foundry Games, we wanted to talk more about the heavier stuff, especially when it comes to mental health or especially talking about death and how to overcome, because this all comes from personal experience.
Right. Lindsay, I think we have to rewind back a little bit on you. I know you have games that uses hugs to start the game.
Yes.
I was looking through your profile as well, and you also have games that are are increasing awareness on black communities. Mm-hmm. So do you mind sharing a little bit about that?
Sure. The first thing I'd ever explain is that games are kind of a 21st century medium. So we take a lot of the ideas that we may have exposed in poetry or theater or movies, and we make them playable. And by making them playable, we're creating a more engaging medium. So with Big Huggin', for example, the idea was that a lot of times when there's a problem in a game, we tell people to shoot it or to squash it. Mm. And in this game, the idea is the only way to solve the problem is through 12 degrees of hug. Big hug, small hug, and you hug past the obstacles. And in other games, I explore ideas around historical events and create what we call docu-games, documentary meet games. And then in other cases, it's about trying to encourage people to see the world through someone else's eyes.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds great. I mean, I would totally enjoy a game where you can just hug someone and problem solve. Yeah. All right, I want to touch a little bit on what William said just now about some of the problems surrounding gaming, or misconception per se about gaming, right? You know, when we talk about gaming per se, especially, you know, when parents talk about it and see their child gaming, you know, spending hours at a time, you know, in their room stuck, and also playing, for example, violent violent games, shooting games, like you said just now. What are some of the misconceptions about gaming that, you know, we like to squash when it comes to? Because there are games like what you've created that are not the aim to do all this, and are quite contradictory of what, you know, people are saying. William, if you mind addressing it first.
Right. So the misconception when it comes to video games is that, okay, so I grew up with video games. I started playing games when I was 3. I started playing the MS-DOS version of Doom, where you have to boot it up through the command prompt. Very geeky stuff. But I did it when I was 3, thanks to my family. I was exposed to all this kind of, because my family, they come from a tech background. Mm. So I was exposed to tech stuff, building my own PC at the age of 5 kind of thing.
Wow.
So I've been playing games as far as I can remember. And truth to be told, I didn't really did really well in my academics because of video games. Okay. But I came to realize that there are a lot of life skills, for example, driving a car, can be improved through video games. So, for example, your hand-eye coordination, your reflex time to probably avoid an accident, all comes from a lot of repetition. But at the same time, I also came to realize that it has to be done in moderation. It takes a village to raise a child, right? Mm. So it has to come from the educator's side. The parents has to control, or has to at least limit or educate them about the repercussions of video game addictions.
Excessive gaming, yeah.
Yeah.
Sakina, what about you? Are there any other benefits you think of, or misconception that you like to squash when it comes to gaming?
I think about how we treat people as humans, even. Mm. When I was younger, I played a lot of games that is single-player experiences and very story-driven. And I think that kind of taught me how to tell stories and how I am today. And I've played a lot of other indie games that deals with a lot of smaller topics, smaller games, and I think it's a nice way to connect with people. It's a nice way to learn about other people's culture. It's a nice way to talk about hard topics like dealing with cancer, death, the recent pandemic even.
Yeah.
So for me, this games is just, like Lindsay says, another art form.
Yeah. Lindsay, do you agree to this?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things I always emphasize is that games are basically based on play, and play is a very natural human state. It's how we learn, it's how we experiment, it's how we engage with others. So when we play games, we engage with communities as well. It's not just about the game, but it's the people we play with. And it's also about exploring other worlds and seeing other perspectives. And I think those are all really healthy things.
Yeah. All right, so just based off, you know, what you've shared so far, I would like to know personally from all three of you, how do you get into, well, gaming, but also wanting to make something out of, you know, creating video games that help people, for example, with mental health issues, with creating socially conscious game, with, you know, disseminating stories of our cultures. Let's start with Sakina.
How do I start?
Yeah. Or it's wanting to make that jump into gaming first, and also wanting to make the change, positive changes through it.
Okay, so, well, when I was younger, the first time I even touched a game, I feel like I knew I wanted to be in the creative line, no matter what I do.
Yeah.
And then through that, I think games have evolved so much. And really being exposed to games like Never Alone really made my eye like open up to see what other things that I can do with games. And through my work with in film and documentaries and with Pusaka, it really made me want to show the world what is Southeast Asian culture, what is Malaysian culture. And that's really the passion that I have.
Yeah. Lindsay, what about you?
Short version is I was offered gameplay as part of I was a sick kid, and they were like, if you get poked or do all the other things you're supposed to do with the doctor, they let you play. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love with them, wanted to make my own games, started making them when I was around 10 or so, and then 12, 13 years later, I started teaching games. And it was really, I got tired of helping people just walk into industry and wanted mm-hmm. to encourage them to make more meaningful experiences. Mm-hmm. Profit comes and goes, but the kinds of things we're talking about here where like seeds are planted mm-hmm. and people find new passions and understand the world differently was really what motivated me. It was the recognition that games can be an art form, that games can be a medium that solicits, encourages pervasive change.
Yeah, very worthwhile impact from spreading this. What about you, William?
My inspiration came from these two, but also because
we've just made him to say that.
It's also because it came from our life experience as well. Like I've been a gamer my whole life, and I've seen coming up from an Asian family, we are all engraved in that Asian mentality where you have to be a doctor, lawyer. Yeah. And if you fail, you dishonor your family and stuff like that. So I just want game as a medium where you can, at the same time, you can have fun, but mm-hmm. you can also benefit from it as well. Mm-hmm. So it as a developer, I want to have that kind of balance where you can have fun, gain something, but not get too addicted to it. Mm-hmm. So intentionally, as a game designer, we try to have roadblocks for that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, inspiration came from these two. I was exposed to it first by Sakina, working with Sakina,
That's good.
I'm exposed to Professor Lindsay Grace here. Okay. So it's been amazing.
That's awesome. Right, there's one more question before we go to break. You know, there's already a big community, or rather like a cult following with certain games like Dota, like Valorant. I'm just saying this because I don't play games as much, but I know people who are, you know, really hardcore followers of this kind of games. And so what sets this kind of games, you know, games that are actually creating social impact, games that actually have sort of a deeper underlying agenda to it, from the other kind of games that already is a big thing here, not just in Malaysia, everywhere, right? So what's the target audience, and how do we widen that target audience?
I think actually it's interesting that you just asked us to talk about our origin stories, because mm-hmm. I think a lot of it is an origin. The longer you play, the more you want out of the medium. It's just mm-hmm. like after you've seen six blockbuster films, you mm-hmm. want more out of that seventh. Yes. And so I think a lot of it is actually about maturation and matriculation. People basically start developing more of a taste for finer wine. They develop mm-hmm. a finer expectation of the games that they play. But generally, in terms of wide demographic, that's usually the key to the success. It's building something that hits us at different levels. So some people want competition from a game. Some people want a game that's actually going to hit them emotionally. Mm-hmm. Others want to be part of a community when they play. And some of the most successful games that have wide demographics hit all of those notes.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, with your games that are, you know, specifically looking at Southeast Asian cultures, are there a lot of traction to it? Are there people who are, you know, who are into this game, who wants to explore these games more?
Yeah, so when we made Cabaret initially, and it's still the case now, a lot of our fan base or sales come from the US, but a lot of our social media, when it comes to like our TikTok, for example, is all Southeast Asian or local, and that is how people find us. Like some of my interns even tell me that I found your game through TikTok.
Oh, okay.
And
yeah,
more
TikTok,
and more, and more and more people are reacting to the art, to the characters, to the stories, and then they would tell us like they've never seen their culture represented on, say, a console like Xbox, and they never knew that it was an option for them for the future. And for me, I think that is the most important thing for us, is that we planted a seed, and the next generation will think about what kind of games do they want to make about their culture.
Yeah, that's a very great way to put it. William, what about you? Like, what do you think of games, the audience, the kind of audience that you attract with your games?
Right, so because the topics that we are dealing with is a really wide spectrum, so we need to kind of narrow down so that we know what to do. So right now, we're currently making Sunset Satellite. It's about a girl who has the ability to look at, to be able to see dead animals and communicate with them. So what you do as the player is to help them move on. So we are dealing with death. We're talking about very heavy topics that are really stigmatized in the society.
Yeah. I mean, I hate to end on a somber note, but we're going to go for a quick break. Stay tuned. Hi and welcome back to It's About Youth. I'm Fana Shea and I'm joined by three game developers, or rather experts in the gaming industry here. There's William, Sakina and also Lindsay, to talk about making socially conscious games that can help, you know, people not just play games for fun and for the creative part of it, but to really explore pressing issues of today's world. Now, before all that, I want to talk to Sakina first about being a woman in the gaming industry. What are some of the challenges that you face? Is there any, you know, what are the perception of people when it comes to, you know, telling people that, hey, I'm in the gaming industry? And also, would you encourage people to be, or women rather, to be in the gaming industry?
I feel like if you asked me this 5 years ago, I think we'll be here all night. I had a lot of problems trying to get into being taken seriously as a woman in game and also a woman that owns my own studio in Malaysia. And I am happy to say that things have changed over the last years. And it may or may not be partially thanks to people seeing me being out there and talking about my studio. Things are coming up, but there's still a lot of work to be done. Like, there still need to be more women in positions of power, and not just in indie games, but also in bigger studios. I'm seeing a lack of that as well. So it is a long way, but I'm hoping that I'm noticing a lot more girls coming into like the education space. Like they're enrolling in games courses. So my hope that this will be the next generation of women in games that will change the way people will look at it.
Yeah, and I think it's nice to have a woman's perspective in the gaming industry, right? Because it's not just skewed to sort of one genre or one area of knowledge, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, all right. So according to the Southeast Asia Game Industry Report 2021, Malaysia's gaming market valued at $786 million. It is the third largest in Southeast Asia. In fact, AMDAC said it will bring in 1.5 billion ringgit, about $370 million, by 2024. So gaming industry is thriving despite the pandemic, despite anything, it's thriving definitely. So I would like your thoughts on where does the gaming industry actually stand from, you know, on the ground perspective, as well as what does it take for it to develop to become more international, you know, to be known more globally. William, we can start with you.
Well, one thing's for sure, we know that video games is resilient towards pandemic. Mm. People always want to play. Whether if it's for learning reasons, whether if it's for de-stressing or connecting with friends outside of their own country. I think it will be here for a long time, longer than we would think, because historically speaking, we've seen it way back in the days. People play, right? So I think it will continue to grow, and for us, as the Malaysian developers to bring our game outside to the international stage, we will need a little bit of help from our partners within the region and also internationally as well. There needs to be a knowledge sharing platform where we can exchange views and basically just sharing knowledge and not just keep it to ourselves and, you know, be a bit of just because I give it to you, then I will lose out, this kind of mentality.
So not really profit-based mentality.
Yeah.
Sakina, what do you think about government support so far? If you have any comments on whether or not the gaming industry here, or for game developers such as yourself, William, are they being supported enough, or are there enough incentives for you guys to be creating more of this kind of games that are helping people?
Okay. a lot of things I want to say, but maybe I'll be a bit more PR.
It's okay, we have time, don't worry.
A PR person sweating bullets. So the short answer would be there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. There is government funding towards game development right now, but a lot of it, I feel, is skewed towards profit-based. Mm. Not enough goes into like games that we kind of want to make, talking about culture or any other social impact games. There's not enough room for like experimental games or games that go into museums or things that are not just for mobile, you know, where you can just purchase and purchase. It's not just trying to get an addictive loop. I feel like we are still quite far away from understanding that, but the more we see our neighbors in Southeast Asia and also in Australia, what they're doing is really great about like education in games, teaching people that games are not just, like you say, shooting games or mobile games. There's a lot of things that you can do with it. There's a lot of sectors that you can put with it, like tourism. And I think that's where I feel like we need the most support, especially when it comes to games for impact. Mm-hmm. It's still a long way. And I just hope that me talking about this here, that they will start looking into things that are not just building or bringing in bigger AAA studios into Malaysia, but also cultivating the creativity and the talent we have, because we have talent.
Yeah, definitely.
We just need to grow them.
I mean, I'm just looking at the pages like Persona Theory and Twilight Foundry. You guys definitely have the talents, and I'm pretty sure there are a lot more people like you out there that are just waiting to burst out of the seams, you know, just trying to make it out there, but probably don't have enough to go by. So, Lindsay, from an international perspective, right? What do you make of taking Malaysia's gaming industry to the international stage?
Sure.
What does it take? And, you know, from your research, from your experience, what leap do we have to take? You know, what obstacles do we have to go through?
So I think one of the things that people forget is that as a 21st century medium, games actually need to avoid being a monoculture. Mm-hmm. If we make the same kind of games, then we actually are likely to see declining interest in our games. So the way to prevent a monoculture is actually to expose and involve other cultures. This is the reason that we need more women in games. This is why we need more minorities in games. This is why we need games from other countries, because the things that we generate are usually most interesting when they're informed by diversity. So I think one of the first things to recognize is that there is cultural impact in participating in the games industry and guiding the designs and incorporating cultural elements from Malaysia in the kinds of games that we produce, which is why we're doing the kinds of activities that we're doing here in Malaysia around encouraging more Malaysian games. I think the other side of it is that there's also an opportunity to sort of grow from within by taking advantage of indie game marketplaces, by putting games on Steam and the app stores. And I think that the awesome thing about the games industry is there is an opportunity to come in at the ground floor and make huge impact. There are games that cost $5,000 to make, but make $500,000. And there are games that cost $500 to make and have millions of players. And so I think a lot of it is about putting the energy behind it and then declaring a sort of space for these games.
So really, I think just based on what the three of you said, just thinking it thoroughly on how we can really develop this gaming industry and not just looking at it as a one-sided thing, right? Exploring other avenues, creating more platforms, for example, right? Just drawing on that, we are on a show called It's About Youth. So we are talking about youth per se. So how do we actually incentivize youth specifically, you know, to become game developers, and also not just game developers, but game developers who are interested in creating socially conscious game or games for impact, like you said. Lindsay, we can go first.
Sure. So I've been faculty teaching game design for 20 plus years, and I can tell you the pattern is basically someone plays a game, it becomes uniquely meaningful to them. Mm-hmm. So it may be a game that didn't necessarily intend social impact, but they found something important in it. The same way you might read a book at 12 years old and say, that book meant more than maybe it should have. And that tends to drive people to say, wait a minute, this is a medium where I can start driving conversations, where I can start encouraging people to see the world through my eyes, or expose parts of my culture to other people who may not be familiar with it. And so part of it is really just about exposure. It's about making great games and then people experiencing them. And it's just like planting seeds, that they grow and more people want to make more games like that.
Yeah. Like you said just now, like Never Alone was your game, you know, to go to.
Yeah.
And that's what started it, was it?
Yeah. The backbone of why Persona Theory Games make Southeast Asian games is because we were exposed to a game like Never Alone. Mm. And thanks to this program, I got to meet one of the people who worked on it.
Yeah.
So for me, it's really meaningful.
Yeah, so meeting people who are behind the games that you play,
yeah,
incentivize people to take on developing as well. What about you, William?
I think youth these days. So last year, I've ran a few game dev workshops for kids, right? Kids ranging from 10, as young as 10, all the way to 16, 17. And I see that a lot of them are actually quite passionate about video games, just that they cannot differentiate between developing it and playing.
Mm.
So they kind of like thought they can gel it together. And once they got exposed to actually making the game, they're like, nah, this is not for me.
Okay. It's a bit too technical.
It's either that or maybe they just don't have interest.
Okay.
Right? But I think it's good to expose them earlier so that they know what they want.
Talking about training and exposing them earlier, I understand there's an event called Game Changers, is it, coming up? And do you mind sharing a little bit about that, any one of you?
Sure. So the short version is the Wysela Game Changers is an initiative. The ASEAN nations basically have sort of ambassadors, if you will, of game design. We're convening. We're doing 2 days of training and then 2 days of a game jam, which is basically a kind of game-making festival. It's similar to if you were to get a bunch of musicians together and say jam. They improvise a game in 48 hours. It's a thing that we've done all over the world for different initiatives. And it's really exciting because it helps people realize how accessible game design is. It helps them sort of come up with a new idea that they might not have had in a low stakes environment. But people are actually incentivized with financial sort of winnings if they do well.
And the best thing about this program it explores, you know, socially conscious games, right, to address issues like climate change, women empowerment, like that as well, right?
Yes.
Yeah. There you have it. Three game developers or experts in the gaming industry talking about making games that are socially conscious, that are representative, that are dealing with, you know, serious important issues that might not be familiar with the kind of games that we used to play when we were little or even now. I'm going to sign off and probably, you know, head on to my laptop and look out at some of these games. So thank you for joining us. I'm Fanashe. Bye.